Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast, is brought to you today in part by Audible, offering anytime, anywhere listening of your favorite audiobooks with the biggest selection ever, and it's all backed by Amazon. I just finished listening to Little Leaders, Bold Women in Black History by Vashti Harrison. Vashti was on the podcast a few weeks ago talking about the book, and Little Leaders was actually the winner of our school's Mock Coretta Scott King Award. I knew I wanted to check out the audiobook because of how well each of the 40 women in this collection is portrayed, both in illustration and text. It didn't disappoint. Having someone read to me gave me a chance to study the pictures more closely as I absorbed the information. I picture my students doing the same as I read to them. This book should not be ignored. Visit the show notes for this episode at allthewonders.com to start your free trial with Audible and support this podcast with the same click of a mouse or tap of a screen. I hope you'll go and try it out and see for yourself. Happy listening. Meet Ben Hatke and a tale that grew in the telling. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 415 of the podcast with Ben Hatke. I always have so much fun talking to Ben, and this time was no exception. Mighty Jack and the Goblin King is the second and final installment in his series, and the way the story expands the first book serves much in the same way that season two of Stranger Things served the first season. Check it out, check the books out, and see if you think the same thing. Where Ben takes us and how he interweaves his characters is so awesome. Enjoy the read and enjoy the listen. Here's episode number 415 of the podcast with Ben Hatke. Welcome back to the podcast, Ben Hatke.
Hello.
I'm glad you're back. Yay!
This is awesome. I'm so glad to be back. It's been a little while since we talked.
It's been a while. You have like a ton of books since we last talked. I'm going to bet, and I think I'm wrong, but I think Zeta Book 2 was the last time you came on.
Holy moly. It was Legends. Okay.
If it wasn't Legends, it was Return.
Either way, we have a lot of catching up to do.
Because I remember getting ready to talk to you and having first visited the first second building, or the floor, and met Gina, and when it was Colleen Venable was still there.
Oh, yeah.
And she showed me some of the art you had sent in for Little Robot. And I remember looking at it like, oh, look, the words aren't even on there yet, but here's the space where they go. And
yeah.
It was a moment.
That's awesome. Oh, and Colleen's headed back to that building. Oh, we have so much to talk about.
She is back. Yeah, if she's not there heading now, back she's to that all, building.
She just
back,
sent
yeah.
me a book the other day called. I've got all my stuff set on top of book. The computer itself is set on The Most Dangerous Book, which is a book that she helped design, and it's the book itself is a working bow and arrow.
Whoa.
Yeah. It's a book. It's like a little pictorial history of archery. It's a beautiful thing. And of all the many projects that I'm not getting finished, one of them is to write a blog entry about this book because it's quite a special thing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, yay. Yay for those connections going round and round. I always loved learning, especially from her, what it means to be the person that designs covers.
Yeah,
For you know, the being a librarian, being a person that knows how powerful a well-designed cover is, that really it does speak so loudly for the book when it's done well. And to I remember when she was leaving and to have her just show the wall of the cover designs that she worked on was like, oh my word, you've connected with all of them.
yeah.
So, but I digress. You're here, and we need to talk about Mighty Jack, and Mighty Jack and the Goblin King is freshly out, but we haven't even talked about Mighty Jack, so I want to talk about this. Ben, why don't I give you a second to just introduce this series to people listening that don't know it yet, and then as I warned you ahead of time, I'm going to try not to nerd out too hard over this, but it might happen, so we're gonna go there.
That's great. No, we can nerd out together. I don't know. So let's see. Mighty Jack, it is a... I mean, I guess if you want to write a blurb about it, it's a modern retelling of the Jack and the Beanstalk story. But I just took that as a very loose beginning because the story itself had such a long time to kind of percolate that it became, in the telling, it became kind of its own beast. So it's a modern story of Jack and his younger sister Maddie and a box of seeds that they pick up at a flea market that turn out to be not of this world. And instead of a single beanstalk, you get sort of a whole garden's worth of magic plants or strange otherworldly plants. And that just leads them from one adventure to the next. Does that encapsulate it pretty well? What do you think?
I think it does. Where I would go with it also that I think it was it last year that Mighty Jack came out? They were pretty close together.
Yeah. They were a year apart, yeah.
Okay, so last year Mighty Jack came out, the first half of the story, and most of the story takes place, well, really all of the story takes place in Jack's backyard.
Right.
So we're in a familiar territory. We know what backyards look like, not a backyard like this, but it's sort of contained. And really that's part of the work that Jack and Lily and Maddie do is to try to contain how things go wild. But then I don't know why I didn't expect it to be this wildly disarming. That when we go into Mighty Jack and the Goblin King, which we see in the end of the first book, that they're going into this portal that's opened up. But to have the entire second book be in another world where nothing seems to operate the way that they're accustomed to, and nothing, you know, that feeling of up seems down and down seems up, was just something that I thought was so fun for you to play with. And specifically the scale is what I was getting at too. That in the first book, we thought the garden was so huge. And then you bring us to a place where there's floating islands that are linked together with vines and so much stuff that was tapping into Final Fantasy and all the and Secret of Mana and all the RPGs that I grew up playing. And I just was like, oh my word, you're making graphic novels out of my childhood.
Yeah. And it's so weird too, because that the creation of these two books together was so different from anything I have done before, honestly. The honest truth of the matter is that they started out as a single story. I wanted it to be a self-contained one-shot graphic novel, and I wrote my script and I sent it to my editor Callista, and she was like, this seems like kind of a lot for a single book. And I was like, yeah, it's fine, I can fit it all in, it's totally cool. And then I actually, like a couple months later, I had to send her this email and be like, there's no way I can actually fit all this in. And so what I ended up doing was cutting the back third, or maybe even less than a third, off of the book. The way I explained it to her was, if this was like a Marvel movie, and the Marvel movies are getting a lot of flack for being like kind of, they have a a template that they all go through,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if this was a Marvel movie, we would be cutting off the final battle in the sky section, right?
I can and almost so, feel where then in exactly. the second book, I can feel it. Got it.
Right. And so I cut that off. And then I was like, when I got, and I was like, cool, cool. And the first book came out and then I started working on the second book and the amount of material that I had was only that. And so I was like, what am I? And then it was wonderful because I, the tale grew in the telling. And that's why we get so much more Lily. And that's why we get so much more happening over there. And such much, to me anyway, it seems like it works as a duology. Better because that second battle, instead of just being the battle in the sky or whatever, became its own story and became something of greater consequence because of it, right? And and allowed the characters to change even maybe even a little bit more. So anyway, yeah, that's how it developed, and it's funny. I don't know. It's funny thinking back. And I've had the opportunity to, you know, when I get asked questions about it, to think back over it and remember how I really did start this, start making notes for the story in like 2006. So it's been a long time since I started. Yeah, no kidding. It almost predates the Zeta books.
Really?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Hard to say. It definitely predates the first. I don't think it predates the Zeta web comics, but it predates the Zeta, the first Zeta like story.
Yeah.
And because when I was working on it, I really can clearly remember the first, God, it's so hard not to say like, it's so hard not to make those. I keep wanting to say like the first seeds of the story or whatever, but it's like such an obvious thing, but it like comes naturally in the conversation. And I always feel like gross saying it, but I remember like looking out, like I was doing a lot of like freelance, like book design and freelance illustration for like textbooks and just whatever came my way. And I was working on, I had like little story notebooks at the time. And I was in the, we had, this was in our old house, which is this really tiny place, but we had a garden and the room that I was using as a workroom looked out over this garden. It was a really overgrown, scrappy, kind of gross garden. And I started thinking about doing, and we would go to the flea market on the Saturdays, and I would start thinking about doing the Jack and the Beanstalk story in that garden. At the same time, we had a friend who she was studying for like a master's thesis or something like this in folk literature, and she had left a lot of her, she left these big stacks of like just really huge collections of folk tales and fairy tales at our house, and I was going through those at the same time, and those two things kind of like sparked that story. And like the early versions of it, if you would look at the notes for the early versions, you would say like, oh, this needs some work, you know, but it's, you know, and I even pitched it. I pitched it a couple times, and it was just, it kind of was like, well, maybe, yeah, like it got kind of a cool response, right, like when it was pitched early on. But then I think it benefited from that kind of 10-year fermentation process.
That makes sense.
And then I think, right, and I think it benefited further then from being split into two books instead of one, because I think it was kind of crystallizing when I got to the place where they picked it up and where I was like, I know where it is. And then when I finally had to break it up into two books, it allowed all those characters to kind of like develop a little bit further. I think it was better for it. And so what I'm saying is like the creation of a story like this is a journey that is not set out at the beginning of the telling. It's something that, I think a lot of stories, maybe not a lot. I think in my case, the story benefited from me learning the story as I was telling it, even though I pitched it thinking like I knew what I was telling, right? So that's kind of the story of where that came from. Well, and you're right.
Please.
But what, like, you're right that the first thing is in Jack's backyard, and So when I started, the very, like, back in 2000, whatever, like, very beginnings of the story, we were in our old house, and I imagined it being set there. And then, you know, between there and then, we've moved several times, and now we're in this old farmhouse. And so really, the world of Jack's backyard is a very lightly modified version of our own house and our own yard. So when you're looking at those panels, like, because I needed a model for a house, I just, like, almost copy pasted my own house into that. So, there
well,
it is.
Well, first, the magic of, you looked outside in your old house, you looked outside to this, like, scrappy garden, and that's, like, where the story started germinating, is to me, like, of all of the stories that I've heard of writers looking out onto this thing, and then it became this other thing, and, like, the story of E.B. White and how he grew up in a farm, just the, like, oh my word, stories really happen from the stuff we just look around and see.
I'm a big believer in that now, and even Little Robot, Little Robot was one of the least fraught or least difficult books that I've worked on. That book kind of just was the creation of it was kind of a joy from start to finish. But there were wonderful sections where there are wonderful parts in that book where I just went out with my sketchbook. There's an old abandoned Jeep in the book that I just sat down in the road and drew from life. There's a railroad bridge that I that's kind of near our house that I walked out to and just sat in the, like, again, on in, by a tree and drew the bridge. So I'm getting to be more and more of a believer in, like, if you want to ground your stories, if you want them to feel real, just set it, just pull directly from what you know. And you find this in a lot of the, I've noticed more and more, you find this a lot of, in the, a lot of the like golden age illustrators that I follow, you know, they could be illustrating like story, like, you know, Treasure Island or whatever. But, like, if you look at some of these pictures, like, oh, that's their grandfather clock in the, you know, they're pulling, like, the actual literal furniture from their house into the illustrations. And then I think the same thing works with writing.
That makes sense. Okay. But I want to jump in here with something that, I mean, you laid this out and it's wrecking my brain in the best way. So for those people that have read, let me just piece this together the way I understand it, and then I want to jump in with the story you made up, okay?
Okay.
This is where we're going. We're going in book two, the story you had to create to fill in 2/3 of the book. That's where I'm going to end up. But so in book one, we have Jack, and we have Lily, and we have Maddie, and there's this creature in the end that ultimately is what entices them into the second half of the story in book two. This thing that I'm not even going to spoil the ending because I don't want to be that person, but something happens to one of the characters that makes it that we need to have book two. We have to go to the second half of this story. It is the reason why there's a quest in the second book. There we go. But to get back to that creature, if I'm to assume that everything not pertaining to the battle with that creature was new material, is that safe to assume roughly? Like, the stuff with the Goblin King, Ben.
Yeah.
That stuff with Lily is amazing storytelling. That whole, the battle, the being brought back to health by the goblins, that stuff was like, oh my word, I never saw this coming. And especially the way that you had, oh my word, my brain's like going to Stranger Things now. Let's not spoil Stranger Things also. But what I felt like is so strong in your story, and you and I can draw parallels, but is that in book one, all the characters are together. We have them together. They're in a battle together. They have a common goal that they're going to accomplish as a team, as one. And in book two, you pull them apart. And so it forces them. They must grow. We must see who they are and how they're going to be able to survive this, and how they can survive on their own, not just with one another, but by themselves and with the people that surround them. And so the way, specifically for me, I love Jack's story and where he goes, and there's so many characters that connect with the rest of your universe that you draw that is we're going to talk about my students. I said, we're going to talk about my students. But the way you went with Lily, you talked about how it gave space for you to understand the characters and develop them more. Specifically, what you do with her is just, it's just awesome and to me. I love that.
That is all the goblin stuff is stuff that wouldn't have been in the story if it was the first thing.
Might not have been.
I know, and I can't imagine without either. And that's like, it's like serendipity, but it's also like, I don't know. That's the part of it that this feels like it's not really you, you know? It feels like the part of it that's that comes when you kind of give yourself over to story.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like, it's crazy. I'm a big believer in like capital S story, right? And there are times when like, I don't know. I don't know what would have happened if I had tried to cram it all into one book. It would not have been as strong. And the chance to do all that, that's clearly, and when you read the book, it's clearly what I'm interested in, right? Like, that story with Lily and I don't know what I'm allowed to. I mean, you say whatever you want.
I mean,
those whole areas of the book are like looking back, I'm like, that's where my interest was, right? If I had to choose, if I had to say where was my stronger interest, I would say it was there, and that's something that I would not have been doing if that whole section of the book was the battle in the sky and rescue mission,
you know, straight up mission.
And then it allowed me to do other stuff, and it was great. It allowed me expand what that world was. And, I don't know. Yeah.
So the way that you build these worlds, the way that, we know, if you've read Mighty Jack, if you've even just read the first book or the first 20 pages of the first book, then you know that there are familiar characters here, specifically familiar to the Zeta universe. Yeah. And it's that I was so excited because, okay, so here's the thing that I said I was going to save until we're on record, but I love talking about my students, so I want to make sure I say it. And that has been, so I'm at this new school, right? And I'm learning, I was telling you, I'm learning their collection, because when you are a librarian and you go to a different school, you have to sort of adjust to what collection already exists and how can I expand upon it. And they had a very humble graphic novel collection, but a very overpowering interest in graphic novels, so much so that that is where a lot of my focus is going on purchasing. But the kids are obsessed, and I mean, they are, like, if there's a character in this collection, I'll give them two. And this will play to one of our mutual friends anyway. But I would say the two books I see circulated in unbelievable ways are the Zeta books and Astronaut Academy. If one's not there, they're asking for the other. I'm like, that is the coolest thing.
That's awesome.
But for me to know that Zeta means what it does to them. You know, ages ago, Ben, when we last talked, I remember talking to you about this because I've since said it to like 30 other people that have come on the show about how cool it is that you make a character and you can see kids at Comic-Cons or even maybe at Halloween, if you get pictures coming back to you, kids dressing up like your character, kids dress up like Zeta. That is a thing that happens. But
yeah, I'm not really used to that. That is still unbelievable to me.
But Ben, I am now in a school where I thought I was at a school before where kids loved your stuff. I mean, they read it. It was never on the shelves, whatever. At this school, children are obsessed with Zeta. It is amazing. Like, I could see them causing, all it would take was me being like, hey, what if we caused as our favorite comic characters? And I would have legions of Zetas in front of me.
Yeah.
It's just awesome. You made that. I mean, come on.
I know, it's like
you made that thing.
Yeah, I know. It just like, I think there's still a disconnect in my brain about that though. It just
That's okay. Here's the way to reconnect it. Ready?
This is the, but I can't as well.
The librarian in me is just gonna say this. Just keep making books, Ben. Just keep doing it. The thing you're doing, your voice, I brought up before the universe that you're making. I love that. I feel like with every book, a reader of yours knows more and more the things that you like, the things that you love. And that's really cool to see. We had these Zeta books, and then all of a sudden these picture books came out with Julia's House for Lost Creatures and with the Goblin. Nobody likes a goblin. Nobody loves a goblin. That book, both of those expanded that world of who you are and who we know you to be. And more importantly, all the kids that see themselves in these books and then know that there's a person making these books behind there that you would be like besties with because you share the same interest. That's awesome to have that.
No, yeah, yeah. It's also terrifying though because I feel like there's a shark out there. And I'm going to jump it one of these days. I'm going to jump that shark.
And everybody's like, I don't know.
Oh, I went too far with that one. But no, yeah, there's no chance of me. Like I intend to keep making books until somebody fires me.
Well,
and it's fine. I don't have a boss, so I guess they can't.
Nobody's gonna fire me. Nobody's gonna fire me. Nanny nanny boo boo. Stinky nanny doo doo. Well,
but yeah, no, and I'm glad you mentioned Nobody Likes a Goblin in Julia's House because I am increasingly, finding, I really love picture books.
They're so good at that medium too.
They're so good though. Over the summer, the art from Nobody Likes a Goblin was all displayed up at the Ann Arbor Comics Art Festival.
Yay!
And it was just like so. The difference is like with a picture book. Well, there are a lot of differences between picture books and graphic novels, but one of the unexpectedly interesting differences for me was that I end up with a big stack of original watercolors. whereas, you know, with the graphic novels, I do ink, you know, physically ink them, but then they're scanned and then colored, right?
Colored digitally. But, okay.
Yeah. Right. With the picture books, it really is, especially with Nobody Likes a Goblin, what was scanned was exactly what was on my desk. There's no digital correction to the point where there were a couple places where I'd made notes on the illustrations to change things digitally and then just never done it. So they really are just straight scanned. And so I like that. I actually like it that I don't know. I think I like it because it makes me feel like old school, like Maurice Sendakker or something like Trina Sharp Hyman, where you're just like, I'm making this thing and they're going to scan it and it's going straight in the book. So that's one. I don't know. I just, I'm loving picture books and I'm definitely signed up to do at least one more, this year.
Great.
There's no end of stories coming from me. And I'm interested in other mediums now too. It's, I don't know.
Well,
storytelling.
For all that you've made already and for all that's to come, I just got to say, as a fan of yours and a friend, that I'm so grateful that you have books in our library that I get the great pleasure of seeing my students love your books and find their identity as a reader through your books and through books like yours. Ben, that's a huge, huge thing that you're doing. And you've amassed readers even just since the time I've last talked to you. And it's so exciting to know that you're the guy behind the books, because when I share conversations like this with them, when they get to meet you at comic cons or at book festivals, you're such a good guy and you're creating these worlds for them and for you. And the act of creating those side by side, that at least that's how I perceive it. That's how it looks to me, that it's for you and for them. That's a really special thing that continues to draw them in. So thanks for that.
Yeah, but no, it's special both directions, though, you know? I mean, like, you're making this stuff, and to see people connect with it, it's like, I don't know. You know, you're getting as much as you're giving, you know what I mean?
I like that.
It's really, really special. And you see that, I don't know, it's just like to be able to, it's crazy. It's like putting those little messages into little bottles and letting them float away in the ocean. And when you actually know that somebody picked them up and read them, it's just incredible. So it makes you make more, it makes you put more messages into those bottles.
Yeah.
It's great.
I love that.
It's good stuff.
Nice. Well, Ben, on that note, why don't I give you a chance to give to your readers one more time by giving you last word. So
oh no, you
I know
yeah,
it's time. Okay. I know. I love this. I never. You know me. I would talk to you for like 4 more hours, but I digress. We should focus. Nah. Save more for those future bottles. Ben, I'll see a library full of children tomorrow morning. Is there a message that I can bring to them from you?
Yes. Let me think. I visited the library today. I was having a bad day. I was writing a story today. Is this? Did you want me to give him like a nugget, or do you want me to just tell you a thing? I'm just going to tell you a thing. This is what I'm going
to. I want you to tell them what you want to tell them. Whatever's on your heart.
So I was having a bad day today, and I'm working on a book. And it was just like every day, you know, this happens. It's totally normal to have a crummy day and to be working on something and have everything not, you know, your brain's just not on, or it's not going the way you want it to go. And if it happens once in a while, that's fine. And there are ways to, you know, to jog yourself back into a good creative space, or into a good space of trying to work or get done what you want to get done. And one of my tricks is to go for walks. I have a whole basket of tricks or whatever. But, you know, when things get really hairy, I go to the library. And so today I was just like, I got fed up. I jumped in my car and I went to the library. And I went to the library and I started thinking about how much I don't know, and how much, you know, even being a grown up or whatever, there's so much you still don't know out there. And so, I guess my thing is like, remember that you don't know things, and remember, that there are people who know things, and that there are vast repositories of knowledge, and like the internet is one of them. But, being able to walk in a space physically that is full of knowledge and that is absolutely full to the gills of things that you don't already know is a kind of magic. And that's what I did today. And I went and I picked out books. So what I do is I'll go like peruse the aisles, and I'll try to find sections of the library of things I'm not already interested in. And that's what I did today. And so I brought back, I forget all the books I brought back, but I brought back a book on physics and a novel that I never would have read otherwise, and a biography of Anton Saint-Exupéry, because those are things I didn't know about already.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 400 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them, and Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with books they'll love. Our theme music is composed by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I would love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com, or rate this podcast through Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that is a very good thing indeed. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep and I'll see you there.